as Dr. Black said, the next two lectures are going to be about laboratory techniques. This lecture, we're going to focus on a lot of the basic molecular biology techniques that I know a lot of you guys have probably already done, like PCR, Western blotting, and tissue culture. And next class, we're going to focus more on maybe a little bit of what you guys don't know so much, unless you've done mouse work, but we're going to focus more on mouse models and understanding different terms, especially because that's going to be really important when you guys are reading papers. And I know personally, I never touched a mouse before I came here and had no idea what the different types of models were. So that'll be really good as well. I know today might be a review for a lot of you. However, we're not going to talk about the protocols and how we do PCR. I'm not going to sit up here and tell you that. Obviously, you need to learn that in the lab. But we are going to talk about why we do things the way we do them and how they work. Because, as my PI always says to me, it's just as important to know how to do the technique as it is to understand how it actually works. So hopefully, you know, if you guys haven't learned that along the way, maybe this will fill in some of the gaps. And a lot of these slides were also provided a lot by Dr. Sheila Feigl, who used to teach this lecture prior to me. All right, so this comes from this handout that I sent you guys, and this was found by a PhD student in our program, and it's really helpful for understanding how things work, the different molecular biology techniques. So when we first hit the lab, there are so many things to learn before we even get started that many things go unlearned, right? So a lot of times the PhD students or postdocs, whoever are teaching you, might only teach you how to do something and not teach you why you're doing that, and it's just as important. Just an overview for today. First, we're going to go along, talk about experimental principles, then get into our molecular biology techniques, and eventually on to cell culture. So hopefully I have you guys out of here early again, if I can. For the experimental principles, this might seem silly, but I know a lot of people come in with various backgrounds, so it's always good to go over it. Of course, this includes things like controls, right? So controlling our experiments, using both negative and positive controls, also things like quantification, what the difference is between qualitative and quantitative, and why do I make you do things, or why does your PI make you do things 3 and 5 times over, depending on the PI, right? So technical replicates versus biological replicates. All right, so first, looking at qualitative versus quantitative, who can tell me what qualitative is? What's the definition of qualitative? Lauren. Exactly. So we've got a change in appearance or other characteristic that might have been observed. So ultimately, what does it look like, right? So cells have become elongated and fibroblastic. It's very descriptive. It's not necessarily giving me a number like quantitative, right? Quantitative kind of speaks for itself. It's quantity. It's ultimately a change in some parameter that you can actually measure and give a number to. It's objectively measured, so such as, for example, 92% of cells show an elongated phenotype as indicated by a length width ratio of greater than 4, right? So it's just actually using numbers. Okay, can anybody tell me what technical replicates are? What's the difference? What is a technical replicate? Why would I do them? Kind of in the term. Eric? Yeah, exactly. So it's really to show that your technique is okay, that your technique is working. So we would use exactly the same sample and do the same technique over and over again to make sure that we're getting ultimately the same result. Right? So it's within a single experiment and ultimately demonstrates consistency. However, what's a biological replicate? Okay, right, maybe on different occasions, right? So not necessarily repeating the technique, but it demonstrates consistency in actually our experimental results. So if I treated a cell line with some drug and I want to know if it upregulates one gene, I'm going to do that on multiple occasions in multiple dishes, essentially, right? So that would be biological replicas. And just an example, looking at a wound healing assay, a technical replicates would be three independent measurements along the length of the wound, so of the same wound. But if we did biological replicates, we would make multiple wounds and make multiple measurements within each of those wounds and ultimately compare those results as well. And one of the biggest things with wound healing assays is that there is a lot of experimental variation in them. So for anybody who does wound healing assays, it's really important to have a large number of replicates when you do that. I don't personally do them, but it's very easy to make different size wounds. It's a lot that you can mess up. All right, so on to the more exciting things. Basic molecular techniques that we think everybody needs. And more importantly, how they work. So, who here has done PCR? All right, almost everybody. All right, who here has done real-time PCR or qPCR? Okay, not as many, right? So you don't normally get to do that in undergrad, too. Who here has done Western blotting? Oh, a lot more people have done Western blotting. Who here has done Western blotting more than one time? Okay, very good. All right, so we've got a mixture of people, right, that have gotten to do all these things. Who here has gotten to work with cell culture, tissue culture techniques? Okay, who here has gotten to work with tissue culture techniques for more than 3 months? Okay, so big differences, right? Okay, so obviously our central dogma, those things that we just talked about, are really focusing on our most important techniques, looking at DNA, RNA, and protein. So we have DNA techniques. One of the oldest techniques is a Southern blot. Who here has done a Southern blot? That's what I expected. All right. We're not going to talk about Southern blotting techniques. Unless you're making a knockout mouse, you're probably not going to do a Southern blot. I did do Southern blots for a long time, which they're a lot of fun, actually. A lot like a Western. Anyway, but we're not going to talk about them because they're not as commonly used. You can use a lot of various PCR techniques. We can use PCR for looking at DNA. RNA, the main techniques are Northern blot. Anybody done a Northern blot? All right, we got one person did a Northern blot. All right. And we have also our real-time and qPCR, and then protein, we have our Western blotting. For DNA, obviously, there's a lot of older techniques also that weren't mentioned on the previous slide, such as FISH and SCI and Southern blotting. And really, that only is allowing us to know whether or not, yes or no, whether or not that gene is there or whatever specifically that we're interested in looking at. You will see a lot of these images when Dr. Block gives her talk, though. Still commonly used, especially for cytogenetics. Of course, our more modern techniques allow actually sequence analysis and are a lot faster, such as PCR and genome sequencing, which is really big. Is anybody in bioinformatics? All right, yeah, a couple people. Okay. All right, so of course, we have to extract our genomic DNA. So what is going to be exactly the first step? That would be cell lysis. So of course, we get our cell pellet, and we actually have to break open our cell, pull out our DNA that we're interested in looking at. For this, we're going to use high concentrations of chiotropic salts, as well as detergents to really break apart those cells. Might even do some vortexing, but probably not too much, especially if you're interested in looking at large pieces of DNA. Vortexing can shear your DNA, so that's always good to know. And enzymes like proteinase K, especially when you're looking at DNA from tissues, you really have to be able to digest up your tissues. Okay, next will be the actual DNA purification part. Where we're going to do a phenol chloroform extraction. Some people use kits for this. I prefer to do a phenol chloroform extraction, and I think it gives some of the best quality of DNA. Ultimately, kits, this is what you're doing, but they call it buffer A, buffer B, buffer, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, right? Here, we actually need to know what we're doing and why we're doing it. So can anybody tell me how a phenol chloroform extraction works? You don't actually have to tell me, but do you feel like you could tell me? Can anybody raise their hand and tell me? Would you know how phenol chloroform works? All right, good. That's good. We're here for a reason. Okay, good. All right, so looking at how phenol chloroform actually works, right? So we have our cells. We've lysed them open, and now we have this mixture of protein, DNA, and RNA all in this aqueous mixture. All right, and somehow we need to extract out only the DNA. All right, so we can use a phenol, which is essentially an organic, to extract out our DNA. And the way in which this works is what it's currently in, right? So we have our sample that's mixed up in this aqueous mixture. It's mostly in water, right, which is polar. We know that water is polar. Phenol is less polar, okay? Now, what is DNA? Is it, according to its charge, is it going to be polar or nonpolar? Does anybody know? Polar, right, it is polar. Why is it polar? I hear whispering. Yes, because the backbone is negative, right? So that phosphate backbone makes it negative, and it ultimately is polar. So is our DNA going to dissolve easily in water? Right? Yes, like dissolves like. So our DNA is going to be continuously dissolved in our water. However, what we also have in our aqueous solution is proteins, right? Now, proteins, what are they normally? So in our body, what do you think proteins normally show on the outside? Do they tend to be polar on the outside or nonpolar? Polar, right? Because we are made up of a whole lot of water, so like dissolves like, they like to be polar on the outside, and the nonpolar residues tend to go on the inside. All right. So if we, but what's cool, so this is actually, I think, really cool. So when we add phenol to our aqueous mixture of DNA and protein, what ends up happening is, like we said, right now, we have our protein, In our aqueous solution, we have our protein with our polar residues on the outside, indicated in dark blue, and then we have our DNA, which is, of course, polar. When we add phenol to this mixture and we mix it up really vigorously, that ends up causing the proteins to flip inside out, and it essentially denatures them because the proteins are no longer happy, right? So their nonpolar residues want to flip to the outside, and the polar residues turn inward. Once that happens, a protein can never go back the way it was. It's now denatured. And when we then go on to centrifuge that sample, what ends up happening is the polar DNA is still as polar, will stay in the upper aqueous layer, and the less polar proteins end up in the bottom organic layer. And now we have this really nice separation of DNA from protein. All right, pretty cool, right? That is really cool, right? Okay. Just as an added note, it's not on this picture, but this is a phenol chloroform extraction. I haven't mentioned at all why we use chloroform. Does anybody know why we use chloroform? Why it's in there? All right, so chloroform allows a nicer separation. It's very dense, so it allows the phenol chloroform layer to go to the bottom instead of, because sometimes if you just use phenol, you'll end up with your aqueous layer on the bottom. And that's a pain in the butt to pipette, right? But if we add our chloroform, it helps that organic layer be much more dense. So we'll definitely end up with our aqueous layer on the top, and it's really easy. Then we can just remove that aqueous layer from the top and perform our next step. But of course, like I said, DNA, it's polar, so it's in our aqueous solution, and we can't see it, right? We need it to essentially precipitate out of the solution. So what we can then do is add a salt, like sodium acetate. Sodium acetate then gets added to our aqueous solution that essentially will interact with our phosphate backbone and cause the DNA to precipitate out of solution, and then we can actually make a pellet of DNA and use that DNA for whatever experiments that we want. However, in water, sodium acetate and DNA, the phosphate backbone, don't always really interact so well. And so if we instead put them in isopropanol or ethanol, that actually allows for a better interaction of sodium acetate and that phosphate backbone. And that's why once you add ethanol or isopropanol, depending on what protocol you're doing, you'll actually see the DNA will immediately precipitate out. Okay, so it's kind of cool. All right, and then a lot of times you might pop this in the freezer to have a faster reaction occur. However, that is not necessary. All right, so far that makes sense? Yeah, cool. Now you guys know why you're doing a phenol chloroform extraction. All right. All right, so next thing might be extraction of plasmid DNA. Has anybody ever worked with bacteria before? I've asked that before. Oh, there's less people that have worked with bacteria. Okay, that's interesting. All right. So if we are doing work with bacteria or in the case of like cloning, we might also need to extract plasmids, which are normally maintained in E. coli. We, of course, can use this wonderful kit, like a mini prep kit or a midi prep or a maxi prep, and it's all buffer A, buffer B, like I said earlier. And they work really, really well, but it's just that most of the time we don't know what's going on. So if we are extracting plasmid DNA, it's slightly different. And in this case, in our first step, we'll again resuspend our bacteria, just like we did with our cells, ultimately, just like we did with our human cells, just ultimately to eventually go on to lyse and denature them. But the difference here is that we're also going to add sodium hydroxide, or NaOH, to this. Now, sodium hydroxide ultimately denatures DNA. So it will denature both the plasmid DNA and the genomic DNA, where you actually get separation of the strands. Okay, so that is the difference. We do not add sodium hydroxide when we're doing normal genomic DNA extraction. Our next step will be to ultimately precipitate that bacterial DNA, and what we want to do here is instead we add potassium acetate. When we add potassium acetate, the plasmid DNA, this actually allows the plasmid DNA to renature. However, genomic DNA is huge, right? Genomic DNA can't come back together, and essentially it just gets all wound up and eventually winds up back in the protein layer as well. So here it actually allows us to get plasmid DNA only. And then we would just undergo a normal ethanol precipitation of the plasmid DNA. So pretty cool. All right, now I'm sure you guys are all familiar with PCR, right? So now we have our DNA, whether it be plasmid or genomic or whatever we're interested in looking at. So ultimately, we want to do PCR so we can amplify small segments of the DNA, whether we want to see whether or not we have that gene, if there's a mutation in that gene, whatever we might be interested in, we can use PCR for that, also known as polymerase chain reaction. Again, we can use this to identify mutations, cloning, and ultimately expression if we use qPCR, which we'll talk more about in a little bit. Does anybody know who invented PCR? No. Carrie Mullis? So Carrie Mullis won the Nobel Prize for inventing PCR. You don't need to know this. But the story's kind of cool. Does anybody know the story of it? Even if they didn't know his name? All right. So Carrie Mullis was driving with his girlfriend late at night, and he was potentially doing a lot of LSD. And he was driving up a mountain, and he came up with this idea to use polymerase chain reaction while he was on a bit of drugs, which is kind of crazy. And then he later won a Nobel Prize for it. So that's kind of cool. But I'm not saying to go and do that. But anyway, very cool. All right, so what do we ultimately need for PCR? We need our nice PCR reaction mixture. Of course, we're going to have... Whoa, things just went crazy. We're done. No. All right, so ultimately for our PCR, we essentially just make up a master mix, right, for those of you who have done it. And I taught a high school summer, or a summer student over the summer, and he was from a high school student, and he said that when I told him that we were going to make a master mix, he started laughing at me and he kept going, "We're going to make a master mix." And I was like, anyway, that was really funny. He was really cute. All right, so for this mixture, essentially what we're doing is just combining our DNA with the enzymes and DNTPs and everything that we need, and then allowing it to undergo this variation of temperature changes, right? That ultimately leads to generation of more and more and more and more DNA. All right, so what do we need for this? We have our DNA template, genomic DNA, of course. We need something to start with. We need primers that match our specific sequence that we're interested in looking at. We might make primers to a specific gene that we're interested in looking at, as well as polymerase, or the enzyme that's actually going to make new DNA, in most cases, TAC, and then a mixture of buffer that's going to contain the salts and everything that we need for the reaction, and our beautiful PCR machine, the thermocycler. All right, so the steps for a PCR, can anybody tell me what the steps for a PCR are? There are four steps. Does anybody know the first one? Yeah, denaturation. It's also on your slide. Right, so we have denaturation. What is denaturation for? What are we doing it? Denaturing the DNA, right? Ultimately, we need to separate the two strands. So we tend to do this at a very high temperature, right? So 95 degrees C for like 5 minutes. This ultimately separates our strands of DNA. Now, what's going to be our next step? Annealing, right? So annealing is ultimately where we allow the primers to anneal to the DNA so that TAC can then come in and elongate the DNA, right? Which is our next step. So annealing is where we have primers actually binding to the DNA. And this can, the temperatures can vary. They're normally around 60 degrees C, but they can vary from primer to primer. And then we will go on to elongate the DNA, normally around 72 degrees C. This is where the polymerase, whether it be TAC or whatever we're using, actually comes in, binds to the prime DNA, and adds our nucleotides in. Why is it at 72 degrees C? Yeah, right? So that's the temperature at which TAC works at, yep. And it's originally found in the heat vents, so it likes that really, really hot temperature. All right, and we're going to go through this a number of cycles. This has 25 cycles, but you can go up to 40 cycles or even higher, and essentially every single time you do this, every time you're going to make more and more and more and more DNA, right? Again, typically around 30, and then we'll eventually just end and hold at 8 degrees C so that we can maintain our DNA at the appropriate temperature. If we're interested in running, if we're interested in looking to see whether or not, say we used primers for a specific gene and we want to see whether or not that gene does exist in our samples, or if we had a mutation or whatever it might be, we can then take our DNA samples and run them on a gel, which I'm sure all of you guys have done, right? So basically, this uses a migration of molecules through a matrix, ultimately based on size and charge, right? So everything goes ultimately from negative to positive. Why do we travel from negative to positive when we're working with DNA? DNA is negative, right? So DNA is going to move away from the negative charge towards the positive one. And then eventually we can image this and see whether or not we have a band at the size which we would predict it to be at, right? And know whether or not that gene was there, mutation, whatever we might be looking at. All right. Now, more interestingly, there are other types of PCR. We talked a lot about basically standard PCR. There's also reverse transcription PCR, which ultimately amplifies cDNA. Why do we use reverse transcription PCR? Does anybody know what that is used for? What's reverse transcription? Yeah, so instead of looking at DNA, we might be interested in looking at RNA, right? So say we're interested in knowing how much a gene is expressed. Maybe I have a drug that I know enhances the expression of one particular gene, and I want to see whether or not when I treat with this drug, if the gene's expression increases. I can extract out RNA, do reverse transcription to make cDNA or complementary DNA, and then run normal PCR on those processes, right? There is also qPCR or quantitative PCR, which we can use to amplify DNA or RNA. And this ultimately can give us a number. Instead of me looking at a band and saying whether or not that band is there, we can actually know how much of that RNA is there, or essentially how much of that RNA or how much of that DNA is there. So for reverse transcription PCR, we're going to do an RNA extraction. As normally, most people use Trizol. You can make your own Trizol if you want. And one of the people who designed and developed Trizol is actually a PI here, Dr. Saki, which is very cool. And for an RNA extraction, I'm not going to go through the whole steps because it's very similar to DNA extraction. Does anybody know what the difference is between an RNA extraction, what basically the difference is between Trizol and just phenol chloroform? All right, so the only difference is the pH. So at a pH of about 4 to 6, only RNA will be in that upper aqueous layer. If we have a pH of 7 to 8, both RNA and DNA will be in the upper aqueous layer. And that's literally the only difference, which is very cool. So just that alone allows us to only extract out RNA. However, you still need to, when you're doing an RNA extraction, it's still beneficial to use a DNase and degrade any leftover DNA that might have gotten into that sample. All right, so ultimately, reverse transcriptase PCR, or just RT-PCR, is semi-quantitative because it compares. You can use that to compare signals on a gel. So we can see, is this band at a higher intensity than this band, and at least we can know low, high, versus just yes, no, right? We can know along a scale, so to speak. And this ultimately detects cDNAs and is indicative of RNA expression. And for this, we use, and I'm not going to go into all the steps for this, but a lot of times this is also just a kit where we do reverse transcription and ultimately generate RNA into cDNA. Why do I have to make cDNA? Why can I not just do PCR on RNA? Yeah, right? So that's, yep, and that's obviously, it's not what TAC does, right? So, yep, so we need to actually use a reverse transcriptase, which ultimately converts our RNA into cDNA. And then we'll go on to use this cDNA as a template. There is, of course, other things involved in that reaction, but it's similar to a regular PCR reaction. Instead, you just use a reverse transcriptase. The next step, and probably one that you guys are all going to do, and one of the best ones, I think, is qPCR or real-time PCR. And ultimately, this is quantitative PCR, and how this works is pretty cool as well. So again, you can amplify a short segment representing a gene that you're interested in looking at. But instead here, what's an additional component that's added to that PCR mixture is this DNA binding dye called cybergreen. In some cases, there are other types of dyes as well. One of the most common ones is cybergreen. And this actually will fluoresce. And what it does is it will intercalate into the double-stranded DNA. So the more double-stranded DNA we have, the more fluorescence reading we're going to get out, right? And we use a PCR, a real-time PCR machine, that ultimately measures fluorescence after each cycle. So remember how I just talked about how we allow PCR to go out for 25, 40 cycles? This machine actually measures the fluorescence reading after each cycle in each of our samples, right? And so if we have If that's the case, right? So after each cycle, we measure out fluorescence. If that's the case, if we have more of a certain gene or more of an expression of whatever we're specifically looking at that we made primers at, to look at, are we going to see that fluorescence occurs earlier or later? Earlier, right? So we're going to see the fluorescence peak come up earlier, and that's what we call a CT or a threshold cycle. So we know that samples which have higher, if we're looking at RNA, higher expression of a gene are going to have an earlier cycle, let's say cycle 19 or something like that. Now another important aspect of this is being able to have our controls involved in this as well, right? So we're going to first of all need a negative control, a water control, right? Which we should see that it doesn't even come off at all. It might be a negative reading or that the threshold cycle is really, really, really late. But we also need to compare that to a housekeeping gene. Does anybody know what that means? What's a housekeeping gene? Yep, gene that's uniformly expressed, right? So why do we use that? Why will I also use primers for a gene that's uniformly expressed and run real time on that as well? Yeah, right? So what if on accident, which, you know, I don't have the best hands in the world, I accidentally loaded double the amount of cDNA into one well as I did into the other one, right? I'm of course going to think, oh look, my gene is really highly expressed. But what I will also see is that my housekeeping gene will also be doubly expressed as well, right? So we can divide, or essentially normalize, it ends up being divided, essentially normalize whatever the expression is of the gene we're interested in looking at by the housekeeping gene, and then we can know for sure that our gene is in fact upregulated in expression or downregulated in expression, right? All right, make sense? Because that's also going to be important when we go to do Western blotting as well, right? Or in a lot of different scenarios. All right, so ultimately, quantitative PCR can really quantitate our RNA levels. And this replaces older RNA detection techniques such as northern blotting, which you guys should, we should all be very lucky that we don't have to do that anymore, which is really semi-quantitative too. As I showed you earlier, we actually get a number, a certain threshold cycle, so that really makes it really highly quantitative. All right. So here, like we talked about, our controls for PCR techniques are going to be amplification of our housekeeping gene, and it is really important that you study that, you know, before you do an experiment, that you make sure that your housekeeping gene isn't altered upon whatever treatment you're doing. Like I know in a lot with my work, because it's a lot of dietary components and metabolism heavy things, and if you use a drug or something that targets the metabolism, you'll see alterations in GAPDH and beta actin and all the commonly used housekeeping genes. So we actually have to use a different housekeeping gene because you'll think that your results are a lot different, as you've seen before. Of course, you also need your positive and negative controls as well, so more your technical controls. So DNA template, which we know contain the correct sequence, and of course our negative reaction, like we talked about earlier, we need water or whatever that doesn't have our template. All right. Again, really important, standard PCR is ultimately qualitative, presence or absence of the band. RT-PCR, however, is semi-quantitative, right? So the band intensities can be compared. We have low, medium, high. And qPCR is ultimately quantitative. All right, so moving on to Western blotting, right? Which we use for proteins. Everybody's good so far? Anybody have any questions? You all look really excited. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be like copy number, yeah, things like that. But yeah, you can also say, yeah, if your gene is, yep, at a, like, yeah, I guess ultimately copy number variation, right? Like if your gene is present, more so for some reason, I don't know whether it might be multiple of the same chromosomes or things like that, you might be interested in looking at. I don't personally know anybody that does it for DNA. Mostly I know people that do it for RNA expression, but yeah, but it's kind of cool because essentially it's just a PCR reaction, but with that fluorescence dye, right? Lauren? Sorry, what did you first say? Oh, yeah, so for like DNA and sterility. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that's also really important for things like, because DNA, RNA, right, is everywhere. So that's also another important aspect to keep in mind. Every lab has different protocols for that, so that's not something I was really going to talk about. But like I know for our lab, we actually have a DNA hood that we only do DNA work in. But that's maybe a little bit excessive. I know most labs don't have that. Most people do their DNA work out on the bench. But we actually have a special DNA, RNA area because you can. It's very easy to get DNA, RNA contamination. But it's important to use things like Eppendorf tubes that have been DNAs, RNAs, protease treated, right, things like that, so you don't get contamination. All right, so for Western blotting, ultimately this allows comparison of levels of protein in our sample, right? So again, just going back to my same exact example, if I treated my cells with a drug and I want to know whether or not the protein expression increases, this is where Western blotting would come into play. All right, and the steps for this, again, we're not going to go through all the steps, more so how it works. We're going to eventually just isolate the protein. Everybody does Western blotting differently, too. So whenever you go into a lab, I'm sure you're going to have to learn a new Western blotting technique. After we isolate our protein, you run lysates through the SDS page gel, which we'll talk about why. You then transfer your protein from a gel to a membrane, and then you incubate the membrane with primary and secondary antibodies. And eventually you can detect the signal via film, but a lot of people are moving towards using chemidocs and not using film, which is also another option. Saves you going in the film room, and film is very expensive. So. All right, so if we want to initially isolate our protein, whether it be cells or tissue or whatever it might be, most people use RIPA buffer, but there's a lot of different lysis buffers out there. This is just one of the most common ones. And it's just important to know the things that it does contain are normally SDS, which is our detergent, as well as this can help to disrupt the membranes and protein-protein interactions, right? And we, of course, need to add our proteinase inhibitors. Protein very easily degrades, right? So we need to add our protease inhibitors to make sure that we block any of those interactions. Eventually, we need to quantitate our total protein before loading it on the Western blot, because we want to make sure that we load exactly the same amount of protein in every single well, right? Because again, going back to what I said about real-time PCR, if I loaded double the amount of protein on accident in one well than I did in the other, I'm going to automatically think my one gene is amplified, or my one protein is amplified, even though it's really just because I loaded too much. So we can use a Bradford assay. There's a bunch of different protein assays you can use. You could use a Bradford assay to ultimately measure the amount of protein and determine the concentration of protein within your sample. So you can say load only 20 micrograms or 50 micrograms of protein, whatever you want to do. And the most common one is Kamasi dye, which turns from red to blue when binding protein. And you can use your standard curve, of course, to calculate the concentration. All right, now here's the cool part. Now that we've isolated our proteins, we have to run it on an SDS page gel. SDS, or sodium dodecyl sulfate, is of course our detergent, and then polyacrylamide is our compound that we're going to use because it helps to make this really nice matrix for which the proteins can flow through. And you, one of the reasons we use polyacrylamide is you can make gels at a range of different percentages. So depending on our protein size that we're interested in looking at, we can make a higher percentage or a low percentage, and it just very easily polymerizes. So that's one of the best things to use for that. For preparing this, of course, we need our acrylamide, our SDS, which are our protein denaturant, our buffer, which will help to maintain a very critical and important pH, and then APS and TMID, which initiates the polymerization. And this stuff smells awful. Anybody else that has worked with it? Who here has made gels? Okay, good. Oh, yeah, a lot of you guys made gels. All right. Yeah, so anybody that's worked with that knows that it smells awful. Yeah, and of course, if your lab does not make gels, you can also buy these, but they're like $10 a pop, and it's a lot cheaper to just make your own. All right, so how this works, I feel like a lot of people that do Western blotting don't necessarily know. And if you miss anything that I say, this is really nicely illustrated in the handout that Anand gave you. So, as I really like that handout. So, for this, right, protein, we have our protein which has this really highly tertiary structure, right? And essentially, when we're using electrophoresis, we ultimately want to separate things out based on the molecular weight. But if we have a protein structure, sometimes a protein structure that even has a lower molecular weight might have this really large tertiary structure versus something that might even have a higher molecular weight has a really tight, small tertiary structure. And so if you don't take care of that, they will end up separating out not based on molecular weight, but based on that structure. So what we have to do is take our protein and ultimately denature it, like we said, by adding SDS. We will also add things like BME or DTTT, which can also help to break down those disulfide bonds, which are really strong in our proteins, and that really helps to nicely elongate our protein. The other thing that SDS does is it adds a uniform negative charge. Because like we talked about earlier, protein has both a mixture of charges, right? So we need to use our SDS, which adds nice, even, negative charges. So now we have these linear structures that are all the same charge. And ultimately, the amount of charge that they have, right, and their size, now they can actually separate out based on both charge and size. All right. But then what's really cool, I think it's really cool, is the actual gel. So if we were to just load our protein samples in the top of this after denaturing it and we ran it through the gel, one issue is that the wells that we use, they're very large, right? We load a lot of sample, up to 40 microliters of sample, and you have this massive space. The proteins are mixed throughout there. If you just start running your gel, they won't all be starting at the same position. So what we need to have is ultimately a top stacking gel. We call it the stacking gel because it stacks the proteins. And ultimately, what will happen is by the time it reaches the separating gel, here in the dark gray, all the proteins will be at exactly the same level, right? And then they can enter into the separating gel and then actually very nicely start at the same point and separate out based on molecular weight. This is very cool. Now, the smaller the proteins are, the faster they're going to run through the gel, right? Also very important. But how this actually works is cool. So we have, on the outside, we normally have our running buffer, which is mostly made up of trisglycine. And it's really critical that the pHs are maintained in these buffers. So we have our trisglycine buffer with a pH of 8.3. Now, glycine is cool because it can have, depending on what solution it's in, it changes its polarity and charge, right? So glycine, normally in pH 8.3, is going to have a highly negative charge. And on the outside, we have our also our negative charge as well. So it's going to want to get away from that as fast as it can, so it enters into the stacking gel. So our glycine molecules then enter into the stacking gel. But inside our stacking gel, it's a major pH pH change. We have pH 6.8, and now that it's at pH 6.8, the glycine becomes a neutral charge, which is very cool. So it switches. And that means it's going to start to travel a lot slower. But there's also, in here, our stacking gel and our separating gels are made up of a TRIS HCl buffer. Now, the chloride ions are, of course, very negative, and they're going to get away from that negative charge as fast as they possibly can. So the chlorines are going to end up going in front of everything as they travel through the stacking gel. Right, so we have our up here, we have our chlorines first. Now, there's going to be this really nice charge gradient that is generated between the chloride ions and the glycine, and the proteins get really nicely sandwiched in between those two things. That way, when they hit the separating gel, they're all ready to go. But again, our pH changes back to pH 8.8 in the separating gel, and here, glycine, of course, again becomes highly negative and moves in front of the proteins and just flies down the gel, and now the proteins are just ready to go as they are, which is cool. All right. Now, you can change the percentage of this separating gel based on whatever size protein you're interested in looking at. So say I have a really large protein, like a 250 kilodalton protein. Would I want to use a higher or lower percentage gel to get a really nice separation of my proteins? Sorry? I think I heard higher. Do you all agree with that? Yeah, so actually you want lower, right? So it's very difficult for a 250 kilodalton protein to travel through a really high percentage gel. You're going to be there forever trying to run your gel, right? You'll get really nice separation of your low kilodalton proteins, but you won't. All your high kilodalton proteins are going to be up here in that high percentage gel, and it's going to be very difficult for them to travel through, all right? So, however, you have to keep in mind that when you're using that low percentage gel, you're going to lose a ton of your low kilodalton molecular weight proteins, right? So if you're interested in looking at any of them, or if your control protein, your housekeeping protein, might end up being in those low molecular weight proteins, you're going to lose it. So that's something you need to think about, okay? There are things called gradient gels, which you can hand make. I've never made them, though I hear that they're difficult if anybody's made them before. But there are gradient gels which actually change from high percentages to lower percentages, and you can use those as well, and then you don't even have to worry about losing your low molecular weight proteins. Do you have a question? Yeah. Yep, okay. So this is really important, and it will be important for your take-home question, too. But it's take-home. All right, so we have, so I'm just going to go back through this. So we have our TRIS glycine buffer that surrounds our, gel. So the glycine, again, it can have different charges depending on what conditions it's in, right, what pH it's in. So here, our glycine in pH 8.3 is going to be highly negative. So it says, I want to get away from the negative charge. So the glycine immediately enters into the stacking gel. And ultimately, the pH really quickly changes back to pH 6.8. So now any glycine that is entered into that stacking gel now becomes neutral, because at pH 6.8, glycine is now neutral. And it slows down how fast it's moving. Our chloride ions, however, that are in this buffer, that are in the stacking gel, are highly negative, and they're just going to push in front of everything. So they end up going first as they travel down the stacking gel. Our proteins, are, of course, have that nice negative charge that covers them, and so they're going to be sandwiched in between the chloride ions and the glycine ions, which are neutral. And that makes this really nice sandwich as we enter the separating gel. Once we enter the separating gel, however, the pH again changes, and glycine goes back to being what? Negative, right? Right? So under pH 8.8, glycine now becomes negative, pushes past the proteins, and it flies through the gel, and the proteins are now free to just travel on their own as they go through the gel, and will separate out based on molecular weight. Does that help? Here and again. Okay. All right. Make sense? All right, if you know this, that would be really good, especially in lab, because one of the biggest things, too, I find is that it's very easy to mess up when you do a Western blot. Whether you mess up making the gel or you mess up what you did to the samples, and knowing how things work is going to be really critical for you guys figuring out where you went wrong, right? I know for myself, I accidentally one time did not add DTT, and the samples would not run. It took over an hour and a half, and like there was nothing. They ran maybe an inch down the gel. And I knew right away, I thought back, and I was like, oh yeah, I must not have added something. The proteins weren't able to denature. So that's things like that, it's always good to know. All right, and eventually after you go through all this process, this is an example of a Ponceau stain, and you can see here that you get this really nice gradient of proteins all separating out based on molecular weight. And hopefully you remember to run your ladder, which indicates specific molecular weights on the gel, indicated here. And you can see, oh, maybe I'm looking at a protein of 64 kilodaltons. It's higher in sample 8. Maybe I treated that with some drug. Oh, woohoo, that's exciting. All right, so the next part, now I've run all my protein samples through the gel, right? Now it's time to transfer from my gel to my membrane. Because unfortunately, I can't probe using an antibody on the gel. I need to actually transfer all my proteins onto the membrane. So to do that, I use a PVDF, or some people use a nitrocellulose membrane, which is highly hydrophobic. And I essentially assemble this very cool sandwich. And what will end up happening is I'll put the gel below my blotting membrane, so that my proteins, because they still have that nice negative charge, right, are going to travel from the negative to positive charges, so they'll get right onto that blotting membrane. And this is for our Western blot transfer. So, pretty simple, so to speak. All right, the next part is I actually want to detect a specific protein, right? So I'm interested in looking at, my favorite protein is SSAT. So let's look at SSAT. Well, what I'm going to need is an antibody that recognizes a unique peptide sequence, right, on my protein of interest, so I can actually detect to see whether or not my protein is there, if it's up or down or whatever it might be. The first thing I need to do is block my membrane, all right? So I'm going to block my membrane to prevent any non-specific binding of antibodies. Because essentially, if I just add antibodies to my membrane, what might end up happening if my antibody is not the best antibody in the world is it just goes and binds every single protein possible. But if I use BSA or non-fat milk, some people use Carnation, Good Start, I think, the baby formula even, and that can essentially kind of neutralize the membrane and it'll block and prevent any non-specific binding. So now my antibody is really only going to be able to bind to my specific protein of interest. So what I will first do is add my primary antibody for my specific protein, and then I have to add a secondary antibody that's specific for the species that the primary antibody is made in. So for all the immunologists, I'm sure they know more of what I'm talking about, right? So essentially, these antibodies are going to be made in various animals, whether it be mouse, goat, or whatever it might be. And then I'm going to use a secondary antibody that's specific for that species that my primary antibody was made in. And that will be conjugated to a fluorophore or HRP. And that is then where I can actually detect my secondary antibody. So whether it be a fluorophore conjugated secondary antibody, which I can just scan the membrane and detect fluorescence, or if it's an HRP conjugated secondary antibody, then we would need to add ECL, which will interact with this and essentially generates a light emission, which we can then expose to an X-ray film and see, do I have my band there? Is my band bigger or smaller than my other samples and whatever it might be? All right, and then eventually we end up with something that looks like this. And as I said, it's going to be really important to run also to have an antibody for our housekeeping protein that we're interested in looking at, such as beta-actin or GAPDH, alpha-tubulin, whatever your lab normally uses. And what you want to see is really nice, even loading among each of these samples. All right, so for controls, we just talked about the housekeeping gene, like GAPDH is ultimately a loading control. We also might have a positive control within our sample, whether that be sample that we know has a high amount of that protein, whether it overexpresses that protein that we're interested in looking at or whatever it might be. And also a negative, which is really dependent upon the experiment, whether it be your 0 hour sample or the untreated sample. Now here, Western blot by itself is semi-quantitative, right? So I can look at it and see is my band bigger or smaller and kind of estimate on a scale. So ultimately it's semi-quantitative. But in order to quantify, I can use something called densitometry, which will ultimately detect the pixels in each of my bands. And then I can quantitate those number of pixels. So this is really a way to quantify. You can also use it for RT-PCR if you ran a gel and Western blotting. Like I said, it measures the pixel intensity of each of these bands and gives you a value, which you then normalize to your control protein and then compare those normalized values. So that's kind of cool if you want to do that. All right, so far so good on Western blotting. Okay, make sense? Biggest thing to know is the gel. Did everybody know that beforehand? No, okay. All right, so for cell culture or tissue culture, right? Started in 1900s. Who's already started reading their Henrietta Lacks book? Good, she does ask questions on it. So definitely read it. Okay. So in 1952, there was a development of a continuous human tumor cell line, which is known as the HeLa cell line, which you guys are all reading about. And ultimately, we want to use cultured cells for a number of different things, whether it be development of antiviral vaccines, production of monoclonal antibodies, or production of cell products such as insulin, HGH, interferon. It's an extremely cheap and easy way to do it. Or, of course, for our case, for understanding cancer and neoplasia. The benefits of it, of course, we can carefully control the environment, easily preserved, and we avoid using animals, for those of you who might not like to work with the mice or the rabbits or whatever it might be. And it's really rapid and relatively cheap, depending on what cell line you're using. The disadvantages are, of course, you need expertise for it, the identification of what cell type you're doing, and the genetic and phenotypic instability that also occurs in the cell lines, especially for cancerous cell lines, and the quantity, right? Because we tend to need a lot of it just to get the samples that we might want to measure. All right. All right, and there's two different types of cell cultures, both the primary culture, which is essentially just cells that were isolated from tumors or organs, and these are non-immortalized, and they ultimately have a replication limit, right? Does anybody work with primary cultures? Oh, yeah. Oh, what culture do you? Okay, all right. So yeah, so there's a lot of different ones. I know I also work with HPR1 cells, which are essentially primary prostate lines, and they do grow for a long period of time, but once they hit a limit at around 20 passages where they can't grow out anymore. There's also, of course, immortalized cell lines, which I'm sure most of you who have done cell culture work have worked with. These have, of course, evaded senescence, like we talked about in our Hallmarks lecture. Sometimes they're made to overexpress a gene, whether it be MYC or some oncogene of some kind. So stable expression of a gene which ultimately deregulates our cell cycle. Examples of these are HeLa, A549. You can list off a number of them. Of course, there are also adherent and non-adherent cell lines. Has anybody ever worked with non-adherent cell lines before? Yeah? Okay. What cell line? Right. So, yeah, that makes sense, right? Yeah. All right. Yeah. So, you work with leukemia. Yeah. So, exactly. Right. So, there's going to be a lot of non-adherent cell lines, which require a little bit of different work. All right. So, for cell culture basics, we have... Essentially, we need to generate a really nice environment for them to live in, right? So we need to give them nice food, the proper amount of carbon dioxide, and the right temperature, right? So what's the right temperature for most human cell lines? Yeah, 37 degrees C, right? So exactly what we are. Yep, that's what they like to grow in. And what's the right amount of carbon dioxide? 5% CO2, yep. All right, so there's a number of different growth medias. It really depends on what cell lines you're working with, and they all vary in the amount of amino acids, vitamins, glucose levels, glutamate levels is really big too. And a lot of them tend to have a phenol red, which is a pH indicator. And we also will add serum of some kind. Now the serum really gives them all the nutrients that they need, proteins, polypeptides, growth factors, amino acids, lipids, everything that you can think of, vitamins, hormones. And we can use, whether that be FBS, full FBS, or charcoal strip FBS, where the hormones have actually been removed out of it via charcoal stripping, depending on what types of experiments you're doing. And very importantly, it contains antitrypsin activity. Now, what is trypsin? Yeah, so ultimately, we'll talk about it on the next slide, sorry. All right, I apologize. All right, so just going on to, we also need plates and flasks, right? To grow them in. Of course, if they're non-adherent cell lines, that's not what we're necessarily going to grow them in. But these tend to be tissue culture treated, and they are special plates made of polystyrene, which is hydrophobic, and they are tissue culture treated, which makes the surface hydrophilic or negatively charged. As well, and sometimes we can have things that coat the plate, which help the cells to better adhere to those as well. Those are more expensive. All right, so subculturing and trypsin, right, it's a serine protease, and ultimately it cleaves the adhesion proteins like integrins that cells have as well. And importantly, its optimal activity is at 37 degrees C. And a lot of times people don't do this. They'll add trypsin to their cells and then they leave them in the hood. It's really important to add trypsin to your cells and then put it back in the incubator because you'll save yourself, you know, hours by the time you're done with your PhD. All right. And ultimately what trypsin does is, right, it's cleaving our adhesion proteins. It allows the cells to come off of the plate or off of the flask, whatever you're using. And then we can grab those cells, spin them down, and put them into new flasks, whether we need to trypsinize, put them into new plates and keep propagating them, or if we're going to use them for measurements of protein or DNA, whatever we're interested in looking at. And this also contains our chelating agent to help this the serine protease along, whether it be calcium and magnesium. And ultimately, like we said, we can neutralize it with complete serum-containing medium, and that's really important because trypsin will kill your cells if left on for too long. Now, aseptic technique is really something that you have to be taught right in the lab, and we can talk about it, but it's never gonna, you're not gonna learn it if you don't have somebody show you. But of course, cell culture must be kept sterile. What must it be kept sterile from? Yeah, all sorts of things, right? So like so not just bacteria and fungus and viruses, right? Not just that, but also we need to make sure that if we have two different cell lines, that we keep those separate as well. That's also very important, right? Something that we often forget. We often think about bacterial contamination, but that's also cross cell line contamination is just as important. And it's really important when thinking about this to have a sterile work area, of course, good personal hygiene, and sterile reagents and media, and of course, sterile handling, which I'm sure if you haven't already learned, someone will teach you along the way. And I'm not going to go through this because we kind of talked about it. But these are just your summary slides for everything that we talked about. Does anybody have any questions? No? Anybody? No? So far, so good? All right, this is all take home too, so that'll be good. And I didn't mention it last time, but the hallmarks questions will be short answer, if that helps anyone. But I'm sure you guys will be fine with that. But this will also be a short answer, but you guys are going to get the take-home before the beginning of next class, so you have ample time to do it. And every exam has a take-home, if they didn't already tell you that. All right. I'm all set. Good job, guys.